As the heart began to beat more strongly, I was drawn back, and I was intensely annoyed, because I was so interested, and just beginning to understand where I was and what I was seeing. I came back into the body really angry at being pulled back, and once I was back all the clarity of vision of anything and everything disappeared, and I was just possessed of a glimmer of consciousness which was suffused with pain. It is surprising to note that this dream, vision, or experience has shown no tendency to fade like a dream would fade, nor has it shown any tendency that I am aware of to grow or to rationalize itself as a dream would do. I think that the whole thing simply means that but for medical treatment of a peculiarly prompt and vigorous kind, I was dead to the three-dimensional universe. If this is so, and if, in fact, the experience of liberation of consciousness in the fourth-dimensional universe is not imagination, it is a most important matter to place on record. Since my return with the injections there had been no repetition of any sort or kind of the experience or of the clear understanding that I seemed to have while I was free from the body. Thus ended the record, said Sir Auckland. What are we to make of it? He asked. Of one thing only can we be quite sure. It is not fake. Without certainty of this I should not have brought it to your notice. But, was it a dream? Or does it record a symbolic vision of one aspect of reality translated into adequate words? I do not know. Whichever or whatever it was, it provides us with a scheme that helps to make picturable to our minds things otherwise difficult to grasp. First, it has helped me to define the idea of a psychic continuum spread out in time like a plasmic net. It does more, it provides a comprehensible background for the soul paleontology of Jung, and it seems to throw a flood of light on the meaning of soul abysses discovered by the method of Freud. It brings telepathy, clairvoyance, spiritualism, and indeed, all the parapsychic manifestations into the domain of the picturable. It also provides a rational-seeming background for such ideas of the group or national soul and such a conception as the psychic atmosphere. But, most important, it makes the idea of the lifelong unity of body and soul much simpler to grasp. Of course, added Sir Auckland Geddes, I do not imagine there is a visible psychic stream, but I do quite definitely believe that the record I have read presents in words one aspect of man's complicated being and relationships, as these were symbolized in the mind of a man at the point of death. The clouds of personality, that were not clouds, as the record says, show how inapt to describe this adventure in, or dream of, a world unknown to our five senses, ordinary words are. Personally, I regard the record as a valuable symbolical impression of a man's body-soul as it disintegrates in death, and of the existence of a racial psychoplasmic net extended in time. There is one, important, point that we must notice before I pass on. There is absolutely nothing in the record which is metaphysical. The whole adventure, if such it were, took place on the plane of nature. It is thus to be sharply distinguished from the records of the spiritual adventures of the mystics. These belong to the plane of spirit, which is supernatural. I do not understand why Sir Auckland Geddes thinks that this particular experience is to be sharply distinguished from the spiritual adventures of the mystics, because they belong to the plane of spirit, which is supernatural. To my mind, it seems evident that many of the mystics' spiritual adventures were probably ordinary out-of-the-body experiences such as Sir Auckland related, though in some cases one might be justified in classing them as metaphysical or spiritual, because the actual facts regarding what the subject had seen while out of his body may have been interfered with or supplemented by dream matter during that difficult stage when the etheric body seeks to reoccupy the physical, and endeavors to establish consciousness therein. On the other hand, there are many records of out-of-the-body experiences that have been brought back untouched and unspoiled by any imaginary matter. I respectfully submit that Sir Auckland Geddes is wrong in regarding this particular adventure as unique. There are many such authenticated records in the annals of psychic science, but it is probably the first time such an experience has been brought openly before such a body as the Royal Medical Society. On the same occasion on which he read the foregoing record, Sir Auckland referred to the hitherto incompletely explored area of man's being. He remarked that medical students learned some zoology, physics, chemistry, anatomy, physiology, pathology, etc., etc., but they were never given a chance systematically to study man as a whole. Beyond their scientific knowledge of man lay an incompletely explored area in which important things happened without discoverable physical cause. But they had all become so sure that science was the only door to knowledge that they tended to ignore the older ways of approach. If they could reawaken the sense of untrammeled wonder, which in the days of the Renaissance gave birth to science itself, they should make fresh starts along new lines, but for the time being, and for a little longer, science was queen of the mind. The brilliant record and achievement of science showed how rich had been the prize won for each of them by disciplined curiosity, but that must not obscure from them the fact that today science was running into blind alleys from which it could only emerge by escaping from direct touch with human understanding. They could not grasp man as a whole. This did not mean that it was impossible to improve their understanding. On the contrary, once they had ceased to fear what seemed to them non-rational, and recognized that human reason could not grasp all reality, they could get to know a lot about him. The body-soul of a man was only the house in which his real self lived. Man was also a spirit, and this spirit in some way had become a partner in the body-soul, making the diagrammatic formula of man, body-soul-spirit. Chapter 24. The Light That Never Fails. In the last chapter but one I mentioned the luminous glow that surrounded the etheric body of my husband and the dog when they visited me, also the fact that the aura of a living person displays a more or less radiant quality which appears to fluctuate according to the health or emotional state of the individual. Judging from all I have heard from reliable sources, and from what I have seen myself, I believe that the more highly evolved the soul, meaning the mind, personality, and character of the person, might be, the more brilliant would be the emanation of light from the etheric body. Those students of the subject who have learned how to become conscious of and in both bodies, and can exteriorize the etheric, and contact other planes and beings, undoubtedly show a greater degree of light in the aura than the people who are so fixed in their physical bodies, either by lack of initiative in psychical matters, or doubts as to the possibility of attaining personal success in any efforts they might make in such directions, that they never exteriorize or function in the etheric at all under normal conditions. By functioning in the etheric, I do not refer to the mere act of projection, which is nothing in itself, leads nowhere, and is simply a means without an end. As already stated, it can and does take place under the shock and stress of an accident, explosion, or while under the influence of an anesthetic. The crucial point is, what use do we make of our powers in this direction? If we so desire, we can learn much, both on the astral, and on our own physical plane, because the faculty of loosening the etheric rightly understood and used leads to greater sensitivity. Whether this sensitivity makes us open to destructive suggestions, or hopeful, illuminating, and constructive ideas, depends entirely on our willpower and freedom of choice, which we all have the God-given power to use, or not use, according to our desires. If we are seeking truth in our investigations, we shall find ourselves reacting to, and attracting, the thoughts that are the best for us. I read somewhere, but do not know the author's name, the following words. Seek truth at all times. Do not grovel with the false things of the world. Truth leads upwards, untruth downward. Truth holds kinship with God, untruth belongs to the evil one. Truth is open as the day, and its presence is light and joy, while falsity reigns in darkness and dishonor. Battle against error and wrong, be not turned aside by every wind that blows, but be strong in purpose, and keep fast hold on the hand of truth, she will prove a faithful guide. All the so-called psychic gifts, such as clairvoyance, clairaudience, inspirational speaking or writing, manifest more strongly in an individual whose etheric body is easily loosened from the physical. An undue degree of looseness may carry with it certain disadvantages or dangers. Some authorities on the subject believe that an ignorant and indiscriminate use of such a faculty would lead to many mental and physical troubles, particularly epilepsy. To know that one can use a certain power or thing, and to choose to use it well is a fine achievement in itself, I think. Socrates said. There is no difference between knowledge and temperance, for he who knows what is good and embraces it, who knows what is bad and avoids it, is learned and temperate, but they who know very well what ought to be done, and yet do quite otherwise, are ignorant and stupid. To be satisfied with mere eating and drinking, and the material conditions of life, does not take us any distance on the road to progress. No matter how attractive and comfortable our surroundings may be, we must not stagnate in them, and so fail to reach out to the higher, but more subtle beauties that lie just beyond the ordinary range of our physical senses. This is so well expressed in the following words. Thou mayst not rest in any lovely thing, thou, the wert formed to seek and to aspire for no fulfillment of thy dreams can bring the answer to thy measureless desire. The beauty of the round, green worlds is not of the world's essence. Far within the sky the tints which make the bubble bright are wrought, the bubble bursts, the light can never die. L. Larcom. So many writers and thinkers of the past seem to have been impressed to use the idea of brilliance, light, color, or radiance in describing conditions, people, or objects of the other world. They have got the mental idea of an actual objective fact. The etheric bodies of those souls who have permanently left the earth plane, the so-called dead, are strangely brilliant when one sees them in contrast to the darker, duller tones of the physical world. When they are living on their own natural plane, their bodies would be more in keeping with the surrounding atmosphere and scenery. The whole general appearance of the higher astral planes is considerably lighter than that of earth, as I will describe to you in a later chapter. Again, if the soul of a person still living in the physical body, but approaching death, exteriorizes and makes itself visible to any other person on earth, it is seen to be extremely radiant. Sometimes this actual radiance is the only indication that an astral visitor, whether still of the earth or from a higher plane, is present. The actual form itself is not seen. Many people who do not think of themselves as being possessed of psychic powers, see unmistakable rays, streaks, or balls of light, for which they cannot account. These are usually emanations from an independent etheric body. The appearance of the light sometimes lasts for only a second or two. I think that the length of time, and the size and intensity of the light, depend on some momentary fusing of the magnetic essence of both the astral visitor and the observer. In my own case, and according to the experiences related to me by reliable witnesses, the longest and the most striking manifestations of light have occurred to me just as I was waking from sleep, and known that my astral was slightly exteriorized, though I was mentally functioning consciously and clearly in my physical body. On one occasion, when staying at a friend's house, I awoke and felt my attention drawn to the right-hand side of the room. There I saw a most brilliant light, which, as I looked at it, proceeded to divide itself into hundreds of separate rays, which arched themselves in most graceful and symmetrical fashion to about 8 or 10 feet in height, playing like a beautiful fountain of golden fire for at least 5 minutes. I lay and watched it, fascinated by its beauty. It declined gradually, exactly as if it had been animated by some power which had run down, like a battery. I felt that it was a manifestation of the presence of a loosened soul, one who was about to die. Actually, I think I had been completely exteriorized myself while asleep, and had been with both my husband and this other person, who was a keen worker in spiritual and psychical matters, and both he and I had then known that his soul was preparing for departure from earth conditions. At the time, this was merely a psychic impression on my part, but was very soon proved to be correct by other events that quickly followed, terminating in the death of this friend a short time after this demonstration. On another occasion, in my own house, I was sleeping on the ground floor in a room leading into the garden. One side of the room is entirely of glass, so one gets a good view of the garden. One night I awoke with the familiar feeling that I had just returned from some astral experience, and found I was lying with my face turned toward the window, outside which a large poplar tree stands, about 6 feet away. To my astonishment, the center and several of the branches were lit up by a most vivid and dazzling display of many lights. I turned my head this way and that to see if there was any normal reason for the phenomenon, such as powerful headlights from a car on the promenade, but there was nothing to account for it. As I looked, the lights grew in brilliance till the effect resembled that of the well-known and popular golden rain in a firework display. It continued for several moments, and was a delight to behold. As in the previous manifestations of a similar kind, it died down gradually as if the life of it had been withdrawn. Again I got the feeling that it was the phenomena of another passing of an evolved and progressed soul, which turned out to be true. It happened a few days later. Chapter 25. More about light. According to many writers and authorities on the subject, rays and streams of light are often visible at the actual moment of or just before death. Andrew Jackson Davis gives instances to this effect in his writings, and I once had an opportunity of witnessing an unmistakable demonstration of this kind in the case of a relative by marriage who was passing over to the other side. This relative was a man of 76, who had been extremely active all his life. Though he suffered from heart trouble and other complications for some years, he was usually doing some work about his house or garden. In fact, he was doing so until a few days before his passing. On January 7, some complications of a difficult nature set in, and the doctor assured the family that, as the patient drew near to his passing, it would be necessary to have expert nursing and attention, and he strongly advised them to send him to a nursing home. Acting on this advice, they agreed. An ambulance quickly arrived and conveyed him to a local nursing home within easy walking distance of their house. The family, his invalid wife and three daughters, were able to visit him frequently during the daytime, but were rather disturbed at the idea of leaving him alone, except for the night nurse at the home, all night, as all his life he had been accustomed to his wife sleeping in the same bedroom, and the certainty that his eldest daughter was within easy call, and would be with him at any moment. One of the daughters was suffering from heart trouble herself, another was recovering from an indisposition. The third had to look after her mother and a sister-in-law who had been extremely helpful, and was not very well herself. I had a strong impression that I must ask to be allowed to be with the patient during the night till he passed over. I felt that my husband, who was the patient's brother, would wish me to be with him during the nights until his passing, so that when the time came I might help him in the same way that I had helped my husband should he happen to pass during the night time. I had a strong conviction that he would do so, and felt it would comfort his family to know that he had someone whom he knew with him, and who would tell them exactly how he passed. So at 10 p.m. on the night of January 9, 1936, I arrived at the nursing home. A terrible gale was raging, torrents of rain were falling, and the wind blew with tremendous force. The sister in charge had told me that afternoon that it might possibly be a week before my brother-in-law passed over, and suggested I should defer the sitting up at night with him until later on. Quite naturally, they did not welcome the idea of strangers being in the home all night. Obviously, some people might make themselves a nuisance, but I assured them I would not be a trouble in any way, so they kindly placed an armchair at my disposal, where I could sit about 5 feet away from the patient, and watch him with the aid of a good light from an electric table lamp on the mantelpiece. When I arrived he was only partly conscious, but seemed to realize I was present. He had a healthy pink color in his face, head, neck, and body, and his feet were nice and warm. Acting on impressions arising out of previous experiences, I had made up my mind not to try to seek any possible phenomena, but to give out to the patient in every way instead of using up any power myself. I gave him tiny draughts of water in a teaspoon, and wiped out his mouth with the glycerin and honey concoction which I had brought with me ready mixed, just as I had done in my husband's case. This and the water evidently comforted him, as he smiled slightly each time, and sighed contentedly. Between doing this, I sat in the armchair, facing him sideways, when I could watch every expression. Mentally I called on three doctor friends in spirit life, the three that helped me with my husband's passing. I asked them to help in assisting the etheric body to withdraw from the physical gently and peacefully. About midnight I became strongly aware of the presence of these doctor friends. I did not see them, but I knew they were there. Every hour, the nurse who was on night duty in the home came in on her rounds and looked at the patient. The gale was dying down, and there was peace and quiet in the room. Occasionally the patient moved slightly into a more comfortable position, but otherwise seemed to be unaware of, and untroubled by, his surroundings. His breathing still remained regular, though rather heavy, and his color good. In between attending to his physical needs, and adjusting bedclothes according to his temperature, I persistently held the thought of peace and hope over him, thoughts which are so well expressed in the lines by Adelaide A. Proctor. Child, do not fear, we shall reach our home tonight, for the sky is clear, and the waters bright and the breezes have scarcely strength to unfold that little cloud, that like a shroud spreads out its fleecy length. Then have no fear. Soon after 4 a.m. I went and sat in the armchair by the fire. About 5 or 10 minutes past 4 o'clock I saw clearly and objectively a bright stream of light playing between the head and feet of the patient. This stream or line of light was of a reddish gold color, and very vivid. It might be likened to the color of forked lightning when seen in the distance over the sea. It was rather arched in shape, like a crescent, but the arch not quite so accentuated. The ends of the stream of light did not seem to be attached to the physical head and feet, but to something invisible to me, that seemed to be about 6 or 8 inches immediately above the physical head and feet. The stream seemed to be alive, exactly as Andrew Jackson Davis has described it, as if animated by a current of vital electricity. I was able to observe it for about 30 or 40 seconds. After that it faded, so I rose and went over to the bed. The patient still went on breathing naturally as before. I felt impressed not to touch the body in the region in which the light had been playing. He was lying on his back, but by putting my hand carefully under the bedclothes sideways, I assured myself that his hips, legs, and feet were comfortably warm. I sat down again, and at 4:45 I noticed that the part of the room in which the bed stood became enveloped in a kind of mist, so that it was isolated or shut off from its surroundings, forming a kind of little world of its own. The outer edge of the mist was roughly circular in form. It was clearest in the center, immediately round the patient, then became denser toward the edge. It was rather like looking at a scene through a circular window or portal. The clearance within the mist was lit by the luminous glow which I have mentioned several times before, and within this lighter part were several human forms. Probably the glow was produced by the emanations from these astral bodies. One of them stood very near the bed, between myself and the patient. Part of the bed was blotted out by the form, which appeared to be opaque. The figure and face had their back to me, but partly turned to the right, so that I saw the profile. It was that of a girl of about 18 years of age. She was dressed in an old-fashioned manner, of about the time 1880, I guessed. She wore a greyish or lavender-colored dress, with a slight bustle effect, and deep flounces on the skirt. The bodice was molded tightly to her figure, which was extremely slim. She was bending over the patient in an attentive and expectant manner. Afterwards the patient's relatives told me this was his sister, who died at the age of 18, and whom I had never seen. This vision lasted about the same time as the stream of light, then disappeared. I remained seated in my chair, the patient still breathed. Then suddenly a strange stillness crept into the room. One cannot describe it. It is like a complete suspension of everything, as if all life is stopped for a few moments. During it, I heard the breathing going on, but this extraordinary stillness still persisted. I had noticed it on a previous occasion while watching a dying person. I got up and stood by the bedside again. The breathing stopped, quite suddenly, yet with absolute ease. There was no gasp or sign of the slightest discomfort, simply a withdrawal. One could not think of it in any other way. It did not seem like death, that is, as many people visualize death when they think of it as a difficult or painful process, but I knew he had ceased to function in his physical body. I did not call the nurse immediately, as I was impressed to talk quietly to him, telling him to dissociate himself from the physical, and give himself entirely into the care of the spirit friends that were around him, with absolute confidence. Then I called Nurse, and together we gave the last physical attentions to the cast-off body that remained behind. All the time I held the thoughts of peace and well-being positively in my mind. May I say here that I feel it is a very great help to the departing spirit, who may not have entirely disentangled his new body from the old one, and who may be conscious to some extent of influences and personalities around him, if some familiar and trusted person attends to, or assists in, those after-death attentions called laying out which have of necessity to be carried out so quickly after death has occurred. I know that some people look upon it as an unpleasant or even uncanny task, but surely any action, any service which may give comfort to another soul in an important change or crisis, should be looked upon as a privilege, a thing of beauty, a chance to serve, and what better time is there than at that greatest change of all, the road's last turn, which, as Horatius Bonar said, leads where the hidden wound is healed, where the blighted life reblooms, where the smitten heart the freshness of its buoyant youth resumes, where the love that here we lavish on the withering leaves of time, shall have fadeless flowers to fix on in an ever-spring bright clime, where we find the joy of loving, as we never loved before, loving on, unchilled, unhindered, loving once and evermore, brother, we shall meet and rest mid the holy and the blessed. I must confess I was tempted to omit the last two lines, because I don't want to rest too much over there, and I hope I shan't meet only the holy and the blessed, unless their holiness has been diluted with a sense of humor, a spirit of joy, and even fun, as so many of our spirit friends assure us they possess, and which, after experiencing many years of communication between the two worlds, I believe to be true. Since I had the opportunity I have just recorded of witnessing the display of radiant light just before death, I have heard from several people that they have observed very much the same phenomenon during the dissociation of the physical and etheric bodies. Chapter 26. A wonderful experience. After having made several excursions into the astral world during sleep, and accomplished other short-distance exteriorizations while awake, there came to me the crowning adventure, the most convincing and satisfying experience of my whole life. Never in my wildest dreams had I dared to expect such a wonderful revelation of that world which lies beyond the normal sight and hearing of our earthly existence. Ever since my husband's death in February, 1935, I had prayed daily, morning and evening, that I might be allowed some day to visit the place, locality, condition, call it what you will, in which my husband now dwelt, worked, and lived his life apart from me. Yes, apart is the word one is compelled to use when referring to separation by death in the bodily sense. No matter how great one's belief in the unseen world may be, the absence of constant objective evidence of the dear one's presence is frequently a great strain on even the staunchest faith. I prayed that such a blessing might be vouchsafed to me once, and that if God's will permitted it, I would rest contentedly on the memory of whatever I saw or heard for the remainder of my life on earth. As I say, I prayed continually that this should happen. Several months passed, and I still sent up the same prayer. Lord, if it be according to thy will, and only so, let me see my husband on his own plane, in his present natural condition, that condition or place to which it has pleased thee to call him. Let me see him as he really is, and I will ask no more. I will continue with whatever earthly tasks shall come my way, happily and thankfully, if I may have this one definite experience. The most marvelous happenings seemed to come to us unexpectedly, on Saturday morning, September 14th, 1935, the day opened for me with its usual round of work and domestic duties. It gave no hint of the almost incredible adventure that was to be mine before the evening came. It was a fine sunny day, so after a rather late and simple luncheon of salad and brown bread, I sauntered out to the garden to see if there were any odd gardening jobs to be done in order to ensure that the place might present an appearance of Sabbatarian orderliness on the following day. I took with me my husband's watch, which I usually place on a table in the summer house, where I can pop in and remind myself of the time, Any practical gardener knows how it flies when once one has become engrossed in dislodging a healthy crop of weeds from their unlawful territory, or removing a few depressing rows of old beehorns and netting. Absorbing work, isn't it, fellow enthusiasts?